is Laskin against SMS Services.
May it please the court, counsel. My name is Suzanne Tongring, and I represent the plaintiffs appellants in this case. Sharon Laskin left her employer, Jeffco Laboratories, Inc., in 1974, and Burton Isaacson left his employer in 1979. They had 28 years and 29 years to go, or I'm sorry, Sharon Laskin had 38 years and Burton Isaacson had 29 years to go until they retired. That's a regular occurrence in employer-sponsored plans because the employer conditioned the payment upon the attainment of age 65 and it would be paid in the next year. So in 2008, Sharon Laskin got in touch with Jeffco and said, by the way, my money's going to be paid to me in 2013 and I'm just kind of checking in. And she called and spoke with Jeffrey Siegel, who was the son of the trustee, Philip Siegel, and he said, oh, I don't know anything about that. Let me check. And so he checked, and he got back to her, and he said that the plan had terminated in 1991. They couldn't find her, and they couldn't find Burton Isaacson. And so Sharon Laskin got in touch with the Labor Department, who helped her write an ERISA appeal, ERISA claim and appeal. And Philip Siegel finally responded, and he said, everybody's dead. We don't have any plan documents, and there's nothing we can do. Well, Sharon Laskin had obtained, when in 1976, she was sent a copy of the plan document, so she had provided that. So instead of adjudicating her claim, Siegel simply said, there's nothing we can do. Nobody's ever explained what happened to their money.
Are there regulations for record keeping by terminated plans?
Well, you know, that's an interesting question.
That's why I asked it.
Okay. The interesting question is that people rely on some six-year provision under ERISA.
No.
Right.
I would appreciate it if you'd answer my question. Are there record-keeping requirements, either in the statute or the regulations, for terminated plans? The answer is yes or no, and if it's yes, you can point me to them, and that would help.
The answer would be, Your Honor, that there's a normal six-year statute for...
No. The statute of limitations is not a record-keeping requirement. I'm asking if there are record-keeping requirements.
There's nothing that is stated. The answer is no, that there isn't anything.
That surprises me. I will bet you anything that the answer is yes.
Actually, Your Honor, I do know the regulation extremely well, and there isn't a regulation that addresses terminated plans. There is, however, for an ongoing plan. And Sharon Laskin had she never got notice of the termination, neither did Burton Isaacson. So they didn't know the plan had terminated. Their benefit was not in pay status until 2008 and 2013. A plan that terminated in 1991 that they don't know about couldn't have triggered any inquiry on their part. There are record-keeping requirements regularly for an ongoing plan. When a plan conditions the payment of benefits at a date so far in the future that it's 28 years and 38 years and 29 years, it would seem to me that that the plan sponsor, who is generally the plan administrator, would have to keep the records so that they could pay those benefits.
We are assuming, I think, that ERISA was violated for purposes, but it looks like it was violated in 1991.
ERISA was violated when Sharon Laskin and Susan Isaacson, there was a violation that there was a plan termination in 1991 where they failed to pay out all the benefits. Susan Isaacson learned about the violation after the lawsuit was filed. Sharon Laskin learned about the violation in 2008, in September, actually September 12, 2008. She learned about the termination. So for purposes of statute of limitations, Sharon Laskin responsibly contacted the United States Department of Labor, and she wrote and asked for payment of her benefits from the terminated plan because the termination would have accelerated her right to get the benefit. She would have wanted the money earlier.
Was the plan filed with the Pension Benefit Guarantee Corporation?
This is a defined contribution plan, Your Honor. And defined contribution plans are not covered by Part 4 of Title I of ERISA.
Okay.
Okay. So the district court was just plain wrong on the statute of limitations. The normal statute of limitations for a contract claim, which is what the payment of benefits would be, is 10 years from the denial of benefits. The denial of benefits occurred on February 28, 2009 for Sharon Laskin, and it occurred in right after the lawsuit was filed. It occurred for Susan Isaacson. It occurred in 2009 after the lawsuit was filed. And so the statute is good. Now, on the second issue, there was no plan documentation that was ever produced by the defendant other than a boilerplate plan that the law firm who represents Veronica Siegel produced for the plan that would have been in effect around 1991 when the plan terminated. But we don't know what it was. The only thing that we know is the plan that appears in the appendix. And so, but after the lawsuit was filed, I was able to obtain from the United States Department of Labor the summary plan description, which they filed for the 1991 termination. And in that, we also learned that there were other claims that Sharon Laskin and Susan Isaacson had. And one of those claims that we learned of was that the passbook rate of interest payments that were credited to their accounts, that they should have received actual earnings and not the passbook rate of interest. And so for that purpose, the district court determined that the statute of limitations for breach of fiduciary duty also ran from 1991, and we don't think that's correct. That certainly under Section 413, the actual knowledge standard, which is the 3 years, would have run it meant that the claims were timely.
Right. But the defense and the district court relied on the 6-year.
Well,
from the date of the violation.
But they didn't know about it. They never
got. So what?
Got,
that's not the way 413 is written.
No. It's the lesser of 6 years from known or should have known, or 3 years from actual knowledge.
Would you quote the statute, please?
Yes. It's Section 413 of ERISA. It's 29 U.S.C. section.
1113, yeah, 413 of ERISA.
Yeah, right. So that statute says specifically that it's the lesser of 6 years from known or should have known, or
no,
3 years from
no,
actual it knowledge.
Is, that is not what it says. Let me quote it.
Yeah. Okay.
No action may be commenced under this subchapter with respect to a fiduciary's breach of any responsibility, duty, or obligation under this part or with respect to a violation of this part after the earlier of 6 years after the date of the last action which constituted a part of the breach or violation, or in the case of an omission, the latest date on which the fiduciary could have cured the breach or violation. There's no known or should have known in that six-year part. That's a statute of repose that is intended to prevent claims arising when there are no records and, quote, everybody is dead.
Okay. Well, the problem is that the claim, the termination of the plan was simply an event that they didn't know about. The breach which occurred, which they were required under the terms of the plan to find the people so they could be paid, there would be equitable tolling, certainly, because they didn't know that the plan had terminated.
You know, the whole purpose of a statute of repose is incompatible with equitable tolling.
Well,
you've got the 3 years with a very strict actual knowledge requirement, not should have known, not on inquiry notice, actual knowledge requirements.
Okay.
But if the 6 years have already run before you know about it, it's over.
Okay, but the point is that if they should have received notice, how do you? They didn't get notice of the plan termination. They didn't know that they should have gone to do something.
And
so,
presumably, the failure to send an annual statement was a violation in its own right. Correct?
No, actually, there's no violation. There's
no?
nothing in the statute that requires that an annual statement be sent by the fiduciary. The violation is that they never gave a summary plan description to Sharon Laskin. They never sent her a summary annual report. They never sent her a summary of material modifications. And she didn't know she was supposed to get any because they never gave her any when she left and got the copy of the document with the letter from Marvin Kamensky saying, hey, you don't get paid your money until you have to wait for 38 years. So I would say that the decision by this court in this case is going to have tremendous impact. We cited a case that actually I brought in before Judge Darrow on this same facts.
Counsel, you now have 5 minutes remaining.
Thank you. So
that is including your rebuttal.
Thank you. If there's no further questions, then I'll wait for my rebuttal. Thank you.
Certainly. Mr. Gimbel, I presume.
It is correct. Good morning, Your Honor. Stuart Gimbel on behalf of Veronica Siegel, both individually as executor of the estate of Philip P. Siegel and as trustee of the Philip P. Siegel Revocable Trust. Your Honors hit on the correct point here, and that is the key in this issue in this case is whether Judge Chang correctly granted summary judgment on the issue of whether the statute of limitations bars the claim. The statute of limitations that counsel and plaintiffs are arguing attempts to read out the statute of repose provision contained in Section 413(1). They're treating this as a know or should have known case. That's not what the statute says. The statute has two parts. First, you run it from either the earlier of 3 years from actual knowledge or 6 years from the last act constituting the breach. There is no should have known in that part of the statute of limitations. It's either actual knowledge 3 years or statute of repose 6 years. Now, the only area in which you get into equitable tolling or discovery rule is if you fit the exception to those provisions. Probably Congress decided that because having a six-year statute of repose may result in harsh results at times, they tried to ameliorate that by adding a provision in 413 that says, in cases of fraud or concealment, then you get 6 years from discovery. Okay? Judge Chang walked through the statute of limitations very carefully and determined that, first of all, under Parts 1 and 2 of the 413, the claims were not timely. That's because their claims all arise out of the termination of the plan in 1991. The allegation in this case is that there was an improper diversion of the benefits from the plaintiffs to somebody. There are some allegations.
Do you agree, by the way, with Ms. Tongring that this was a defined contribution plan rather than a defined benefit plan?
Yes, Your Honor, I believe that's correct. This was not defined benefit. This was all based on individual accounts.
And then what happened to the money?
Nobody knows. There is no evidence in the record as to what happened to the money. All you have is an allegation from Plaintiff Laskin.
It surprises me that nobody knows. What responsible plan administrator would fail to keep records? You know, even as of 1991, keeping records on a computer for a plan this size is really simple. Right? If you don't distribute the funds in a defined contribution plan, and you take them yourself, you're a thief. Don't most people want to keep records which show that the people have been paid and they are not thieves?
I would certainly imagine, Chief Judge, that there were records kept in accordance with the provisions of ERISA. This goes to the question you asked
counsel.
That's
my next question. Records kept in accordance with the provisions of ERISA. Ms. Tongring said there are no provisions of ERISA requiring records to be kept. Do you agree with that?
I don't believe that's accurate. I believe that there is a provision that says documents that are sent out in accordance with a plan have to be retained for a period of 6 years.
6 years?
Yes.
So your position is your clients or your clients' predecessors would have retained the documents for 6 years and then thrown them away because the statute of limitations for a prosecution for theft had expired.
I'm sorry. It's not less than 6 years. But, yes, I would believe that after the period of 6 years, it's interesting that the period of repose in 413.1 is the same 6 years as the record retention. Obviously, Congress was saying, if the claim hasn't been raised in 6 years at that point in time, there's no longer an obligation to keep the records. Your Honor, we don't and have never conceded that money was stolen from the plaintiffs. That's an issue on the merits that was never tried.
There are two possibilities. One is the plaintiffs were actually paid. They've forgotten it, and you can't prove it. I gather that was the original defense. The second possibility is that they couldn't be located, but you have no records to show that they couldn't be located. If they couldn't be located, these funds is cheap to the state. But I gather you have no evidence that these funds were ever handed over to the state.
You are correct. There is no evidence of the money being
cheated. So funds that should have been cheated to the state are retained. That's theft. And that theft may have occurred within the period of the statute of limitations. I don't know what the escheat timeline is.
Unfortunately, Chief Judge, because of the passage of 17 years, the people who were involved in the administration of the plan at the time, both at First National Bank of Chicago and Arch Johnston, Mr. Johnston was the comptroller of Jeffco, the administrator of the plan. He had passed away. Philip Siegel was the trustee. He was a fiduciary of the plan, but didn't have any knowledge or particular involvement in the distribution of the funds. I would say that the possibilities that Your Honor raised are certainly some of the possibilities. We don't know what else could have happened. The money could have been reallocated.
Has anybody checked with the state to see whether these funds were turned over to the state by a cheat?
A plaintiff has alleged that they checked, and I have no evidence whatsoever that the money is cheated to the state.
So if this is a defined contribution plan and it was never escheated to the state, the money either was paid or one or more of the defendants or their predecessors is a thief. Those seem to be the only two options.
She had a vested benefit. That's not denied. She either got her vested benefit, the money wasn't escheated to the estate, or we have no facts indicating that. So what happened to the money, nobody knows.
Are there any options other than the two I have mentioned?
Well, Ms. Laskin initially indicated that because the funds were kept in an account at First National Bank of Chicago, there was a possibility that it could have been commingled with assets of the administrator, Jeffco Laboratories, and that the money may have gone to...
As far as ERISA is concerned, commingling the accounts from a defined contribution account is the same thing as theft.
There certainly, we're not arguing that it would be appropriate to take somebody's vested benefits. The argument is that the difficulty in understanding and knowing exactly what happened was because this case was filed 18 years after the event.
This case was filed 18 years later, and because documents that easily could have been retained were not retained.
The documents were kept for at least the minimum 6 years. We have no idea when the...
We actually have no record that they were kept for 6 years, do we?
That's true.
We don't have any documenting their destruction after 6 years, do we?
That's true. The passage of time has caused a great deal of speculation in this matter. What we do know is that there is no dispute that the plan terminated in 1991. There is no dispute that any violation that would have occurred, the diversion, the stealing of the money, to use Your Honor's term, would have occurred at that time. That was the last act for 13-1.
That I understand. So now the statute of limitations in ERISA is 6 years, and the felony statute for theft is 5 years.
Was there fraud or concealment that would allow the plaintiffs to get beyond the statute of repose? That seems to be the point that was argued before Judge Chang, and that seems to be the only way that plaintiffs can try to avoid this issue, the statute of limitations bar. The fraud and concealment has been discussed in several cases. It is either a misrepresentation of facts or it is a concealment of facts. But there's no doubt that all the cases that consider this say that it has to be some sort of a trick, some sort of a scheme in order to evade detection of the cause of action. There's been no allegations, there's been no facts presented that indicate that there was any scheme here to hide a cause of action. The only evidence that's been submitted is the self-serving declarations of the plaintiffs saying, we didn't get documents. Okay, that does not equate, and what Judge Chang said was, I'm not going to infer from that there was actually a conscious decision made back in 1991. We're not going to pay just these two beneficiaries, and we're not going to send them any of the summary plan documents so that we can cover that up. That's really the only argument they can make, and unfortunately, they're leaping to that conclusion. Thank you.
Ms. Tongring, there's one more person to argue. Please sit down.
I'm sorry. Thank
you. Mr. Casciari.
May it please the Court. My name is Mark Casciari. I represent one of the appellees, one of the defendants, SMS Services. And I simply want to make 3 points, one of which is unique to my client. The first point is that this is a summary judgment record, and there is no evidence in this record after full discovery of any sort of imprudence by the alleged fiduciaries. There's no evidence that the steps that the fiduciaries took to deliver any money was imprudent. There's no evidence, for example, that the money did a sheet to the state, as counsel has pointed out. So what we have here is a summary judgment record without any evidence of imprudence by the fiduciaries, and that is enough reason in and of itself to affirm.
Well, if we have, you're saying on the merits.
Yes.
Okay. Plaintiff has a vested benefit. It was never paid to her. It hasn't escheated to the state. Why isn't it a reasonable inference that somebody took it?
Well, the question is somebody. There's no evidence who that somebody is. The fiduciaries have an obligation.
One would expect that the fiduciaries would have an obligation to look after the money and to pay it to the right people. Why is that an look, you guys have a very strong statute of limitations defense.
Right, right.
But on the merits, if this were a case being brought in 1993, summary judgment's got to be denied.
Your Honor, the obligation of the fiduciary is to be prudent, to be reasonable. And there's another possibility here is that...
reasonable fiduciaries don't steal client funds.
Your Honor,
pretty straightforward.
The fiduciary...
There are really only two options.
No,
right?
there's a third.
The plaintiffs were paid and have forgotten, and the defendants can't document this, or the money was stolen. Now, we may not know by whom.
No, Your Honor, there is a third option. The fiduciary took reasonable steps, sent the money out. It was intercepted and stolen by some third party. I mean, that is an option. The point is that the fiduciaries have to be...
The check was mailed but stolen by the Postal Service.
No, it was intercepted by someone where the address of the check and perhaps misendorsed. I mean, that's a possibility. The point is there's no evidence in this record of a fiduciary breach. Secondly, counsel is correct about the statute of limitations. This really is a statute of repose case, and I endorse and adopt his arguments for my client. And then lastly, Your Honor, my client is alleged to be a successor. And that's an independent reason for this court to affirm as to my client, because the evidence is once again, there is no evidence in this record that would establish what is necessary to hold my client liable. And that's because there is no evidence in the record of any sort of continuity in operations. In fact, the undisputed evidence is that my client did not even buy the assets. A different company bought the assets. And that after the assets were purchased, the seller continued to exist. So that is a third reason. And lastly, Your Honor, my client is not even alleged to be a fiduciary in this case. So for all of those reasons, the court should affirm as to all defendants and especially SMS Services. Thank you.
Mm-hmm. Thank you, counsel. And now, Ms. Tarnman.
Jeffrey Siegel told Sharon Laskin that he called Marvin Kamensky, and Marvin Kamensky told him that they couldn't find Sharon Laskin and Burton Isaacson. That's why we knew that. And that's why we found Burton Isaacson's widow, because Burton Isaacson died 3 years after the termination, and we got in touch with her. And she was already part of the case because we brought a claim under 502A2. The fact that the plan terminated shouldn't be the only place where you look at the benefit was to be paid at age 65. When pension plans terminate and it isn't a payable event, they don't get paid sooner. The employer or the plan goes out and buys a deferred annuity contract, and that annuity is paid when it's supposed to be paid. So they had an obligation when the plan terminated to provide the benefit, not immediately, but at age 65, as Marvin Kamensky himself said in the letter. So that's another reason why running the statute from 91 doesn't make any sense. It should be run from the date that the money should have been due. Sharon Laskin found out about it because she called a few years before her money was supposed to be paid, only to find out that they claimed that they didn't know where she was. We have submitted a copy of a letter to the plan fiduciary in 1989 where she gave her change of address where she continued to live until the year 2000. So there was no basis for them to say they didn't know. They also try to skate on the issue of who's responsible for the administration of the plan. The named plan administrator was Jeffco Laboratories, Inc. Whoever Arch Johnson was, being the controller, was just somebody who is not a named fiduciary under ERISA. And Philip Siegel was the sole owner of the company for all those years until he sold the business to his son, Jeffrey. So there is a difference of opinion on what evidence is there. Sharon Laskin was the first one who went to the state of Illinois, and the money didn't escheat. She verified that. It was later verified that Susan Isaacson also, nothing escheated with Burton Isaacson's name. And the reason that they would have known is that a 1099 would have been generated at the time that the account was created, and the IRS would have...
1 minute remaining, Ms.
Okay. The IRS would have been after them for the payment of the tax if the money had really been, an account had been created. As to the issue for successor liability under ERISA, this court recently in the Teed case addressed the issue. Jeffrey Siegel sold assets to SMS Services, LLC. He runs around to the other side, and he is now a member, along with two other principals of another company that he sold one of the Jeffco companies to. They all are together, and they're a they're part of JF Daily International, LTD.
Thank you, counsel. The case is taken under advisement. Our third case for argument this morning.